OWC Radio number 44, my conversation with James Mathers. Everyone, Tim Robertson here, OWC Radio. Thanks very much for downloading this episode. I've got a fun interview with a gentleman by the name of James Mathers. Does that last name sound familiar to you? It did to me, but I didn't put two and two together until... Actually, I never put two and two together this... Well, listen to the interview. You'll see what I'm talking about here in a little bit. In the meantime, James is the president and co-founder of the Digital Cinema Society. If you're shooting video at all, and let's be honest, if you are, it's definitely in digital. This is something that you want to look at. DigitalCinemaSociety.org. You know, they have a weekly newsletter that they'll send out that will give you a lot of information on making the most of your video projects. So they got a lot of stuff online too that they stream some video. It's really, really cool. Check it out. And thanks again to James for coming on OWC Radio this week. Here's something that happened. We did the Tech Week in Chicago, and I had a great time. Look, when you're right downtown Chicago doing a show like we were doing at Tech Week, it's always cool. It's always fun. And it's even better when someone comes to the booth and says, "Hey, I know you. I listen to OWC Radio." So, Rick, thank you very much for stopping by the booth and introducing yourself. It's cool to meet someone that's out there actually listening to the show. And they specifically came by just to say hi. And it's neat. So, if you find out that we're going to be anywhere in your area participating in a trade show, come by the booth. Look at the products. I will be at a lot of the shows. Not everyone, maybe, but most of the shows I'm there. And what I'm going to start doing is bringing the official OWC microphone. There's still such thing. But I am going to start bringing some kind of a portable recording gear so I could start chatting with people in these places that I'm at. I think that would be a lot of fun. So if, for instance, we're going to be at NAB next year, if you know you're going to come to NAB, hit me up before NAB and we can schedule a time where I can sit down with you somewhere at NAB, maybe even at the OWC booth, and we can talk. We'll get you on the show. It'd be a lot of fun. It's a whole different vibe when you're talking to someone, you know, face-to-face, especially at a big event like NAB or CES or... you know, NAM. It's just a lot of fun. So if you hear OWC's coming to your area, you're going to come to a show and we're going to be there, hit me up, owcradio@maxsales.com, and let's get you on the show. Let's have a conversation. I love it. So something was just released that I think is really cool from Newer Tech. Look, I'm the cook of the family, and my wife will be the first to admit it, that she's not really good at... She's awesome at baking, not as great with cooking. I'm an okay cook. I probably experiment a little bit too often, according to my wife. You know, she doesn't always want to try my last concoction, you know? It's like, well, I did this and this, and... But, you know, you got to try new things, right? So with the iPad, it's kind of where I store my recipes now. I use Evernote. If I come across, like, say I'm on Facebook and I come across something that sounds like a really cool recipe or a different way of cooking something, I'll do a print as PDF and then save that PDF into Evernote. Or if someone emails me something, I can always save that email directly to Evernote. So that's what I use, but there's also some really cool iPad apps for recipes and stuff. I've got a bunch of them, probably 20, although I don't use the recipes as much as I should, I'll be honest. And the biggest reason for that is I have a decent-sized counter in my kitchen for cooking, but I don't really have a place to stick my iPad. And I do need the full-size iPad. I can't really use my iPhone, even though it's an iPhone 6 Plus. That's hard to use when I'm trying to read a recipe. Pinching and zooming, and my hands are all, you know, icky from trying to cook and mix ingredients and stuff like that. Well, NewerTech just introduced the kitchen kit. And this is pretty cool. It actually comes with a stylus as well. The stand itself will rotate 360 degrees because not all apps are vertical or horizontal. It's one or the other, so it's nice to be able to rotate the screen. This is something that I was actually looking for, a stand specifically for the kitchen. And if you're interested in this, make sure you check it out, the NewerTech Kitchen Kit. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. This is episode number 44. So if you go to blog.mexsales.com and look through OWC Radio, you're going to see number 44. There will be a link right there to the NewerTech Kitchen Kit. It's kind of cool. Speaking of OWC, make sure, look, if your hard drive is getting full, go to OWC and pick up a new hard drive. I can't tell you how many times I've had to help people. My computer's just running sluggish and blah, blah, blah. And it turns out their hard drive is almost full. Everyone's taking pictures with their iPhone. Everyone's taking videos. That all takes up space on your computer's hard drive. At least, I hope it does. If you're not saving them to your computer, you need to. you really need to get the stuff off your iPhone and get it synced to your computer. So something bad happens to your iPhone, you still have copies of those videos and pictures. My wife's really bad, for instance, about giving me her iPhone so I can sync it with what we call the big computer, which is my workstation. And my workstation is kind of the central repository for all of our digital content. So every home movie that we shoot, every picture that we take, it's all on the workstation. And the main reason, other than it has the biggest screen, the main reason is because that computer is backed up every single day to two different outlets. And the reason for that is we don't want to lose content. We don't have a camera that we're physically taking pictures with that you get film developed. It's all digital now, same as you. And she just doesn't get me that iPhone enough so I can plug it in and pull the pictures out of it. So, you know, hard drives tend to start getting full. And that's okay. We want them to get full because that means we're backing up our data. But if your hard drive gets too full, the entire computer starts slowing down. So consider upgrading your hard drive. You don't need to go buy a brand new computer. All you need is a bigger hard drive. So if you've got a smaller 1 terabyte hard drive, you can double that space for not a lot of money, and your computer's good to go for another couple of years. So if you have the need for a larger hard drive or more RAM, or you want to go with a faster computer and put an SSD in it, boy, your computer will really be fast then. I almost can't use a Mac now without an SSD. It just, man, it seems so much slower. It's saving stuff and opening stuff and booting and ugh. SSD is the only way I'm going to go from now on. Go to MacSales.com, and we've got your Apple computer hookup. Trust me. So with that, I'm going to wrap up this segment. I invite you to send any feedback into owcradio@macsales.com. And we are looking for other people to come on the show and talk. You don't have to be a cinematographer, a director of photography, a director. We're looking for everyday Mac users that could come on OWC Radio. Tell us about your gear and the first Mac you ever owned, and maybe what's going on in the Apple universe right now. I still don't have an Apple Watch. I still don't think I need one or want one. I've seen quite a few people, especially when I was at MacStock a couple weeks ago. Oh my goodness, it was like an Apple Watch convention. Everybody seemed to have one. I just don't want one. I don't see the point in me having one. Especially at the price point they are. Look, if it was $199, yeah, I'd probably buy one. But at the price that Apple is selling the Apple Watch for what I would use it for, yeah, I just don't see it. But I'd love to have you on the show and we can discuss it. Send me an email, owcradio@maxsales.com. We can schedule right here on OWC Radio. So with that, I'm going to wrap up. Let's jump over to my fun conversation with James Mathers. I think you're going to like this. Check it out. And we're back here on OWC Radio. And as I promised at the beginning of the show, we have a special guest this week, which means, of course, we will have the three dreaded random questions. His name is James Mathers. He is the president and co-founder of the Digital Cinema Society. He's also a filmmaker, and he's here on OWC Radio. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
So you are a cinematographer, a director. What do you do in the film industry?
I'm a cameraman, or you might say directorial photographer, if you please.
Well, it's one of the most important. I mean, without you, we don't see anything.
Yes.
Or we see the
horrible. The DP is pretty much in charge of the visuals, under the director.
How much influence does someone in your position have over the look and feel of a movie? I mean, I'm sure the director has the ideas, but from what I've seen and experienced, the director of photography really has a vision himself that he brings to different projects, and it's a collaboration that kind of gets the film what it is.
Yeah, it's true that the DP is the guardian of the image, controls the look. However, the way that you collaborate with a director can be different on every project, can be different with every person. There's some directors that'll be so specific, they'll tell you what millimeter lens to put on, where to put the camera, and they'll want to, specify lighting. Others will just work with the actors and you'll be in charge of everything else, framing, blocking, lighting, of course. That used to be, I go back a ways. I've been doing this for a long time and have a lot of experience shooting film over the years. And, before we used videotapes very much. And, the DP would have a lot more control, it seemed like, in those days because, it wasn't what you see is what you get, where the everybody could hover around the
monitor.
Yeah. And, and sometimes people think, if they can know how to watch TV, they are qualified to steer the ship as far as,
everyone has an opinion now.
It used to be you could just say, trust me, it's going to look great,
Yeah.
And, somebody might look through the monitor, or if they did look at the video tap, it was just a flickering, usually black and white, for confidence of framing, that sort of thing, and wasn't an expression of, what it was going to look like, and the DP was, depended on to make it look right.
So now the gaffers are coming up and saying, that angle is kind of weird.
The gaffers are usually my allies, but there's other people, there's sometimes, I don't do many commercials because I can't stand it, but there's so many people around usually trying to justify their existence, and there's just too much input from everybody, and it'll drive you mad, I like to work with the director and, in many different ways, and that's the person that I answer to, but it's complicated.
So what is the Digital Cinema Society?
Well, as I said, I'm a cinematographer from way back and worked in film for a long time. And going back about 15 years ago, I started to also work with video. It was HD in those days.
15 years ago, that was kind of at the beginning of the whole digital revolution when it comes to film.
It was. And, I was actually, you could call it indie movies, but, the reality of it is it's low budget. And it's sort of where I've ended up in the business. Cameramen get typecast, and I got typecast for doing lower budget stuff, and that was some of the first people besides George Lucas and James Cameron. Those were some of the first people that were trying to shoot HD for features and other type of dramas, so that they could save money.
Yeah, because film exposure and getting it cut and getting it developed, all that is extremely expensive. And digital is, shoot and you can edit on the computer.
Yeah, but in those early days, for major motion pictures, there had to be a good excuse to shoot on HD. In George Lucas's case, he was one of the pioneers with the Star Wars. It was because he wanted to use digital effects, and thought that would be easier to start in a digital area. As I say, in indie movies, it was to save money. So I ended up being an early adopter of shooting movies on HD, little small movies.
Was there one thing that kind of drew you into those, to the digital realm? Because I would have to imagine it's not like you were a new filmmaker starting out and, hey, I'll do the new technology. You went from something established that you knew like the back of your hand to something brand new. Was there any fear? Was that an excitement there? What was it that made you make that switch?
Well, I always had exposure to shooting video over the years, so I was not totally uncomfortable with it, and that's, I suppose, why I started to get known for that. So I was being asked to shoot a lot of movies on HD, and I was starting to become an authority reluctantly, and a lot of people were asking me to speak on the subject and that sort of thing, and I found that there was a lot of misinformation going around at that time. There was the misinformation, for instance, one of the manufacturers was saying with HD, you don't have to light anymore. And as a cinematographer, that just really got my goat. And so I got together with some friends who were also, working in that same kind of area. And we decided that we were going to make a little documentary film to sort of clear the air and take an objective look at it. And we made this labor of love called Digital Cinema Solutions. And we got interviews with George Lucas and James Cameron and Alan Dabbio, ASC, and Robert Rodriguez. And
you met the heavyweights. Steven
Soderbergh, yeah. And we got a lot of cooperation. A local lab in town financed the hard costs, but it was mostly a volunteer effort. And I'm proud of it. I think it turned out pretty nice. We made a half-hour documentary, and they made 2,000 DVDs that were given away free of charge. But the problem was, because everything was changing so fast, practically before we could finish the program, it was starting to become obsolete.
Yeah.
So that's when and why we decided to form the nonprofit group, Digital Cinema Society, and it lives on the web mostly. We do have events, live events in major motion picture towns, mostly LA, because that's where I live and it's easy for me to organize. But we also have events in Northern California, in Chicago area, in New York, and also in London. And we have chapters in all those areas. We also have chapters in South Africa and Germany, Italy, and Australia, New Zealand, and in China.
It's everywhere now.
But it's and we have 6,000 members, we have a much larger reach because we take these events that we have and we record them and we put them on the internet. So we just celebrated our 13th anniversary, and after 13 years, we have quite a library, although some of us are starting to get sort of long in the tooth. but we have all this streaming from our website, and actually, even though we have 6,000 members, which I think is relatively impressive, but sometimes we get views on our videos of 140,000, 150,000. So
what do
I know
you attribute that to?
There's a lot of people nowadays. It's sort of a problem I'm trying to grapple with, to be honest with you. There's a lot of people that that want to view the videos, but they don't want to join anything. People are very reluctant nowadays to sign up and actually join. I think that maybe there's a fear that we're going to, you know, take all their information and be a, you know, data mine it and sell our mailing list. And but we never do that, and we never send a lot of emails. We send one newsletter, which some people think is our most valuable, you know, offering, about once a month, and we send local updates maybe one more time during the month in major cities. But if you're not in a major city, you probably only get one email a month from us. And it's a good way, if you're not in a major city, that you can keep up with the technology, because I don't know if I explained it properly, but it's a nonprofit group, and the basic idea is to help filmmakers keep up with the new technology. It was, you know, originally started because I was a little bit, just a little bit ahead of some of the other people in the adoption, and I wanted to help my fellow filmmakers, you know, try to keep up and make this transition that I was in. And we're all very challenged nowadays because it's just changing so fast, it's hard to keep up with it. And I'm by no means an authority or an expert, really. But I gather the information and sort of sift through it.
I think you are more of an expert than you're giving yourself credit. I mean, you're, in some respects, you're almost becoming an educator yourself.
It's true. It's true. I wear a lot of different hats, but the way I earn my living is as a cinematographer, and this is the Digital Cinema Society, is really just a hobby that's gotten a little out of hand. But, you know, I wish that we could attract more members and that they would trust that we're not going to sell their information. We never do. We never share our mailing list, and we've always been really careful. But I'm just, it's something that's been on my mind lately. So sorry to bend your ear with that. But
No. I hope some people listening to this decides to join up and become members, because one of our core customers nowadays is filmmakers. Filmmakers need a lot of storage, and that happens to be what OWC is good at. One of my questions for you is, how is the whole iPhone, Android, that kind of photography? Is that, and when I say photography, I mean videography, because there's been a couple kind of major projects in the last 2 years, I'll say, filmed on the iPhone. The whole movie is done on the iPhone. Is that spurring some of the growth of the organization?
Not so much. I mean, we're more for people that are trying to aspire to be professional. But I could speak to shooting movies on, you know, cameras. I think it's, you know, today too much credit is being given to the cameras. It's the filmmakers, it's the talent, and the control you exert as a cinematographer that creates the image. It's not the camera. And no, you know, you put any kind of camera, it wouldn't be my first choice to shoot a movie with an iPhone, but you know, it could be done, and I think I'd get good results. On the other hand, it would be much easier to use a more professional featured camera. And what the differences are is that the better cameras, you have more control, and you they have more better dynamic range, more sensitivity, that sort of thing.
And you get better lenses, and I mean,
choice of a better interchangeable lenses are a big deal, and not having so much depth of field. If you have less depth of field, you can you know, control the image that way more.
Yeah, pull the viewer's attention to where it's supposed to be, rather than everything is HD and you're not sure where you're actually supposed to look. And one little bird fluttering in the background will really start to distract people, instead of looking at the characters on screen that your attention is supposed to be on. So having the right equipment, obviously, is very important. On the flip side of that, of course, is the barrier to entry nowadays is almost nil. I mean, they have virtually free distribution over the internet. The equipment that they need to actually film something is relatively inexpensive, but you could still see a huge difference between someone who just took their iPhone out, shot something, you hear the wind blowing through the microphone, and they put it up on YouTube, rather than someone did a professional photographer, a professional video camera. They lit the scene. There's overhead boom mics. You could just tell the difference immediately. Even someone that knows nothing about film can look at that and go, oh, well, one is horrible and one is great.
Yeah, and even though there's a democratization, they call it, of that offered anybody can make a movie, it's really hard to get a mass audience, even though you have access to millions and millions of people over the internet. It's very difficult to reach a mass audience. You know, the studios, I call them the studios, but the major distribution international conglomerates that control that kind of distribution have pretty tight reins on, you know, what gets released and what gets put out to a mass audience.
So let's go way back in time. James is a sophomore in high school. What did James want to do when he graduated and possibly go to college? Did he have any idea?
Ooh, yeah, it was. I was sort of a goof off in high school, I have to admit. And
so you're the other one.
I didn't have any clear idea of what I wanted to do at that time. I was always exposed from a young age to the entertainment industry, even though I didn't come from a showbiz family per se, because they were recently transplants from the Midwest. My older brother was an actor. He played the Beaver character, Jerry Mathers.
Oh, really?
Leave It to Beaver. Oh, yeah.
How about that?
And I also, he's older than me, and he got into it first, but then I also was never famous, but I did a lot of acting when I was young, and I was exposed to the business. So I always sort of had that in the back of my mind. And I should mention that around the time in high school, I was a rock star.
You were a rock star?
Yeah. I was a legend in my own mind. And I played all the big junior high schools in the San Fernando Valley. And but I had to retire, you know.
You can only take the road so often, James.
That's right. It was a hard life.
So, what drew your parents to California? I mean, what was the thing that made them move from, you said, the middle of the country?
Yeah, my brother was born in Sioux City, Iowa. My father took a teaching job out here. He had an aunt that lived in the area, and that's what spurred him to move out. He was actually a coach. He was a high school coach. And
football?
You know, not the typical basketball, mostly basketball and football at a small school. And you know, not your typical Hollywood parents. And he also at night worked at Sears Roebuck. And my mother went to visit him one time with my little brother, or my older brother. And they were casting for the Sears catalog at the time. He was about 2 years old, and he got a modeling job, just sort of by chance. You know, they said, you know, it's,
they probably thought, oh, this would be cute.
Go on the interview. Yeah. So it was fun, and they realized, well, you know, he could make a little money, and he started doing different kinds of acting roles, and he turned out that it was he was very reliable. That's what it is necessary from a child actor. They want him to be reliable. He did live TV, and you know, he always came across, and so he started to be popular with that. And he got a job on an Alfred Hitchcock movie, The Trouble with Harry, and Leave It to Beaver was one of the you know, one of his early jobs, and that went on for 7 years. And
so where did you come in the picture? How old were you, or how old was he when you were born?
He was 7 when I was born. He's 7 years older.
So you were literally born into the entertainment industry. I mean, it's not like you guys moved over.
That it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a showbiz family. It wasn't like that. But it was, the precedent was set, and producers did realize that, you know, that he was reliable, and maybe his brother would be reliable. And so I actually worked quite a bit. I did a few movies, and I was in a TV series in 1960 that nobody would remember. It's called Ichabod and Me. And then I was mostly did a lot of, you know, one guest starring roles, they would call it, in television. I was in episodes of Bewitched and My Three Sons and The Munsters and Adam 12 and some of the shows in the 60s. And about my last job is when I was a teenager. And, you know, at the same time, I was a rock star.
Right.
I just thought I was had long hair. I was too good for everything. And I was on a series with Henry Fonda that most people wouldn't remember. And it was called The Smith Family. And the boy on The Smith Family was a guy named Ron Howard.
Never heard of him.
Who's gone on to be successful. But, you know, I didn't pay much attention to him either. We went to studio school together and... you know, I was cool, hip slick and cool, and he had short hair, and you know, which was, didn't earn him much respect in my book. And anyway, I just blew him off. Didn't have any, wasn't very nice probably, and you know, so look at where we ended up now.
Yeah, well, here's a
he's
question.
One of the most successful directors
right.
in Hollywood.
Absolutely, so. This kind of cracks me up. So you've got the long hair. You're in the band. Did any of your band members know that, oh, that's Leave It to Beaver's brother?
I mean, oh, sure. I grew up with that. I was always Beaver's brother.
Oh, my God. And you're a rocker. I mean, that would, boy, you had to have got ribbed for that.
Yeah, you know it.
So what did
hey,
you go
where's
to,
Wally?
Yeah, well, there you go. So what did you do when you got to college?
When I went to college at Cal State Northridge, I studied television directing.
This would have been in the late 60s?
No, it was 70s.
70s? Okay.
And
So you're at you're going to school at the height of this revolution that's going on in filmmaking at the time.
Yeah, it wasn't so much filmmaking at that time. I would say it was like the golden age of television. There was things like All in the Family and Saturday Night Live had just started, and that's sort of what drew me to do television. It was more like directing live television is what I studied, although I've never really done that professionally. But I got into it. Another reason was because if you concentrated on film studies in the radio, TV, film department, you had to make a senior project, and you had to finance it and buy all that film, which was, you know, people were spending $30,000 and stuff. But if you were a television directing major, then all you had to do is pay the cost of the tape, which was a few bucks. So and then I got a job after that working on the Frost Nixon interviews, and that was not the movie a couple years ago, but was back in the 70s when David Frost interviewed Richard Nixon. And my job on that was the unglorious task of writing down time code numbers, cut in, cut out, and making decision lists because it was the very first electronic editing, and they didn't have computers to keep track of all that. So it was sitting in a darkened room all day long writing in points and out points. Then I became an operator. Wouldn't say an editor, but an operator on this very early electronic editing system. And even though it was offline editing at the time, it was still very expensive, and I would have more experienced editors sitting behind me telling me where to do the cuts. And it was a good experience, but I found that working in a darkened room all day was not very appealing to me. And especially under high, stress situation, you'd sneeze and they'd want to deduct time from the clock, you know?
Oh, boy.
So, I decided to get out of, post-production at that time, and the same little company I was working for also had a production division, and I went and started to become a PA and on set, and eventually worked my way into production, being like a production manager at the small company, and then gravitated towards shooting. It was a small company and very disorganized, and the head of the company was a cameraman. He was constantly getting himself double booked, and he would say, "Jim, oh, you just go shoot this." And so that's how I got some of my very early shooting assignments. And that company did a lot of featurettes and that sort of thing, and educational films, and just a wide, wide variety, all sorts of odds and ends.
So what was, at the time, not including anything recent, what was your, let's just call it your funnest time on set, on any of these shows, say going up to, you know, maybe just a few years ago, but not current, because I don't want you to try to compare anything that you're currently working on and someone hears it and goes, "Hey, what about ours?"
Well, one of the best times I ever had was doing a movie that never got released for whatever reason. Back in the 80s, it used to be that sometimes movies would get financed and they would just be like tax shelters.
Right.
And nobody was really interested in them getting released. And in those days, there was no video distribution. So if it didn't get a theatrical release, it wasn't a real big movie. Nobody really cared. They didn't want to make a small movie. So back in the early 80s, I did this movie called Zadar, Cow from Hell, with a comedy troupe called the Duck's Breath Mystery Theater. And they had, there was like the Fire Sign Theater, not quite as popular. And they grew out of the writing program at the University of Iowa. So that's where we shot this. And the story was about this sleazy, low-budget film crew that comes to Iowa to make a horror movie. And the townspeople end up taking over and making the movie. And that's a great film, but you won't find it anywhere. I hope it gets released someday, but we sure had a great time making it. The people were so, you know, friendly and welcoming, because we weren't in a, you know, in a show business town. People weren't jaded like they are in Los Angeles. And farmers would come up to us and say, "Hey, well, I got a, you know, I got a barn. Come over and shoot at our place." And the catering was done by a bunch of church ladies, and you know, I put on like 10 pounds. It was great. So that's one of the most fun times I ever had shooting a movie.
You know, you can actually get that movie now.
Zadar, Cow from Hell?
Yeah, yeah. There's a website. There's actually a review of the movie on IMDb. And this person said he had heard about it, blah, blah, blah. "I saw that Duck's Breath Mystery Theater, who created it, was selling the DVD through their website. I had to have it." So this, at one point, someone found that and released a DVD. So there's a really good chance that you can actually find it now.
It's got a small cult following.
Very small.
But it's not easy. It's not easy to follow. This group actually is having a reunion concert, comedy concert, coming up in the San Francisco area. So if anybody is, you know, is interested in that, they can probably find it. I might. It's a, you know, it's a trip from Los Angeles. It's, but I'm thinking about it. Those guys are a lot of fun.
I totally would if I were you. I mean, it's part of your history too, you know.
It is, yeah.
So one of the things that we do here on OWC Radio is we ask our guests three random questions, and they're completely random. They're not questions that we prepared ahead of time for a particular guest. It's a big, long list, and I just take the next three questions. And so we're
not guilty.
Not guilty. So we're going to get to that in a minute, but first... where do you see the society going in the future? I mean, digital film obviously isn't going anywhere. The technology keeps changing, sometimes on an unbelievably fast pace. I mean, just a few years ago, I didn't even know what Blackmagic is. And then I'm at NAB, and it's one of the biggest booths at NAB. So the technology is constantly changing. The GoPro stuff, Now it seems like I was at an event at Paramount Studios. Everything seemed to be about the drones, camera on a drone underwater, a drone driving. It was just crazy. How does an organization like yours kind of keep up with that?
Well, I think that it's important to remember that even though we cover technology, it's really all about storytelling. And, you know, things like drones and other, you know, technologies will come and go. There, you know, there'll be excitement for a while, but I mean, they'll persist. But I think that what it really gets down to is just different ways, different formats to use to tell a story. And there's going to be a lot of excitement coming up in the world of virtual reality.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is sort of an extension of 3D. It's 3D everywhere. And, you know, 3D to the fourth power or whatever. But, and there's going to be, you know, so much excitement about that. And, but it's really just about telling stories, you know. And I think that, you know, 2D, good storytelling with, you know, with good technique is going to persist for a long time. I think that maybe there will be a move to the distribution will be in more to the home. I'm not happy to say that, but I think that probably exhibition will, you know, there won't be so many theaters. I mean, because the people's home theaters will start to have such large screens that, you know, nobody will want to bother to go out to the movies. And the movies are going to try to do a lot of different things to grab people, get those butts back in the seats. But and I think that's the long-term trend, is that you won't see many, you know, so many movie theaters going forward. I think there's more happening in distribution than there is actually in production. I think that you know, the whole way we get content is going to change. It's going to be on demand. It's going to be what they call over the top. You know, won't be so much broadcast, or it won't be so much you know, cable packages, but we'll be able to just say, we'll search what we want, like you search that Zadar Cow from Hell on the computer, apparently. And you'll be able to press a button and start watching it, and which I recommend you do.
So you think it's going to be more Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, YouTube? That's going to be really where people go to watch movies, and you think the filmmakers out there are going to start catering to that audience, which to me means less big budget, less money being spent on elaborate sets, and more of a return to what I grew up with in the 70s and the 80s, more the independent films that, you know, the concentration's on story and good storytelling, a Breaking Bad type of situation, if you will, when it comes to storytelling, rather than an All in the Family type of storytelling. You know what I mean?
I would like that to be the case. I'm a champion of independent film, but I also realize that if nobody's going to see a movie that they've never heard of, so you have to have the networks of promotion out there to get the word out, and so the large companies are still going to have great control of what gets you know, has mass distribution, and people are still going to want to, you know, go for bankable stars, you know, or sequels, because they want to see something that they've seen before, or they want to see.
I mean, the audience also, they still want the Avengers Part 6 and Batman versus Wonder Woman. I mean, they still want to go see those movies, and they do want to see them on the big screen, but the vast majority of movies that people see, I think, are on a smaller screen, whether it's a television, a 60-inch plasma, or, you know, heaven forbid, a 4.5-inch iPhone screen. That seems to be where people are watching the majority of their movies nowadays.
And I think that trend's going to continue, along with sort of an on-demand, you know, way of accessing. that material. My only comment is I'm not sure that that's going to help indie movies. I hope it does, but I'm not sure.
Well, right now, the from different people I've talked to, the indie movie scene could use a boost. It doesn't seem to be a lot of independent, I mean, truly independent studios and creators out there that are getting a lot of traction.
I can tell you the stories from the trenches. That's an area that I work in, indie movies, and it's a very difficult way to make a living. There's a lot more passion than there is budget. And, you know, say you want to be have a position like mine, being a cinematographer of indie movies, and I get asked every day if I will shoot somebody's movie for free, and then I own cameras and other equipment, and will I bring all my gear along, you know? And, it's heartbreaking to turn people down, but, I have
to make a mortgage.
I have to make a living, yeah.
Absolutely.
So, it's still, there's a lot of people that are making movies, but they're not being widely seen, and they're not profitable. It's really, well, really,
it's
really
tough. Widely seen.
Yeah. You only hear about the ones that, are the, that hit the jackpot, that make it into Sundance and get recognized and get a distribution. And those are the ones you hear of, but you don't hear of the, many, many thousands of ones that, where they spend their savings and pour everything into it and beg, borrow, and steal and get something done. And sometimes it's, it's a really beautiful film, but if it doesn't get distribution or wide distribution, they never make their money back on it.
It seems like as a filmmaker in the excuse me, in the independent scene, it's not enough just to make a great film. You also have to be a good marketer, and you also have to know social media, and you also have to have those contacts in social media and the internet to try to help get the word out there.
That could certainly
help. A lot of work.
Yeah, that could certainly help. Yeah.
All right. Are you ready for your three random questions, James?
Sure.
All right. Number one, have you ever owned a boat?
A raft, but not a boat.
A raft? What'd you do with the raft?
I've done some river rafting. I like to take it out and also into the ocean, with the kids and into lakes and fish. And I'm also a scuba diver, so I've
oh, really?
Dove off a raft. It's a sizable
wow.
raft, but it's I don't know if you could call it a boat.
Where's the coolest place you ever went scuba diving?
I've mixed work with my hobby of scuba diving, and I've actually been all over the world. The Great Barrier Reef. I did a documentary underwater in Indonesia, searching for a plane. I've dove Costa Rica, a lot in around Southern California, in around the Florida Keys, South America. But probably the worst place that I ever dove was in Ireland.
Really?
I lived in Ireland for a year, and that was, maybe I should have mentioned that as one of the best shoots I was ever on, but it was really a fantastic experience, except for the scuba diving is not good, and it's cold and dark, and there's not much to see diving in Ireland.
What were you filming there?
I was doing mostly a series, a medieval fantasy called Mystic Knights, and I was also doing a TV movie on the life of St. Patrick with Malcolm McDowell and Patrick Bergen. This was a number of years ago in the late 90s, and I just had a wonderful time over there.
Sounds like it. I'm sure that the scuba diving wasn't that much fun, but the rest of it sounds like it'd be just a blast.
It was. I'm of Irish heritage, and it was great to go back to my roots. And the company that I was working for, an American company, the exchange rate was about 2-1 at that time, and they accidentally doubled it the wrong way, And they said, okay, you have this, you know, this amount of money to go out and rent yourself something. And they sent me to a realtor, and, you know, they set it all up. I saw a couple of places and picked a really nice one, a three-bedroom house right on the water, you know, in the suburb of Dublin. And you two guys were my neighbors, and it was, and, you know, they signed a lease before they figured it out, so... It was
they were stuck with it at that point.
It was a grand time, you know, and they couldn't blame me because they, you know, I said, go see this lady and she'll show you some places. You pick one. Okay. But that helped to make it nice, too. I had a lot of people come and visit me, and, you know, it was great.
Number two of your questions. What was the first pet you remember having?
A German Shepherd named Ron Tonton. It was a relative, an offspring of Rin Tin Tin, who was a popular television star at the time. And my brother was already in, you know, acting in Leave It to Beaver, and through some studio contacts, we ended up getting this very special lineage German Shepherd. It was great. That's... I was very close to that dog.
Last one. This is a weird one. And I couldn't answer this one myself. Well, my answer would be no. Do you remember your first haircut?
I don't.
See, haircuts nowadays are a lot different.
Going back to my hip slip and cool days, this was in junior high school, and it was, you know, if... You had to have long hair if you wanted to be cool, and but my father was a, you know, a high school coach, and then he became a boys' vice principal, which he was around this time. He was gone at some kind of camp for the summer, and I don't know, he was in the Air Force Reserves or something. He was gone for a while, and my hair got really long, and then he came back, and I knew I had to get it cut in the meantime, and I had. Developed this relationship with a young lady, you know, because I was independent and had long hair and I was cool, and but my with my father coming back, I had to get my hair cut short, and when I did, she broke up with me. So it's always very,
really
very haircuts have always been very traumatic for me because of that.
You know, haircuts nowadays with my kids, we just go to, you know, the place out by the mall or something like that. But when I was a kid, it was almost a kind of a magical place. It was the same people, these same guys. They were kind of gruff talking to each other and to their, you know, their patrons. It had a certain kind of smell to it. It had the barber pole out front. It was an experience to go get your hair cut. It's not like that anymore.
No.
I don't know if it's better or worse now. Probably better, to be honest.
More expensive,
probably heard some
I can
things.
Tell you that.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely more expensive, but I probably heard some things as a 7-8-year-old that I probably shouldn't have been said in front of me at the time.
Well, that's always where you can find the Playboy magazines.
That was true, too. I got to use the bathroom, Dad. Yeah, I'm going in there with you. James, I want to thank you very much for being on OWC Radio this week. Where can people learn more about you and Digital Cinema Society online?
People could visit www.digitalcinemasociety.org, and they can check it out and join if they're interested. If they can't afford it, go ahead and join anyway, and it'll be complimentary. It's not about money. I just want to try to share this share the information.
Absolutely. Are you on Twitter or Facebook or anything?
We are. Also, Digital Cinema Society. Just search that name. And but we don't pay for any, you know, Google searches or anything, so you might have to look down a little bit to find the proper one.
Well, anybody listening
LinkedIn.
To this, if you go to show notes number 44 for OWC Radio, I will have links to their social media as well as their website. And James, thanks very much for being here, and you have a great day.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.